Hey everybody, how's it going? Thanks for joining me this afternoon. I am Oren McIntyre. So today I want to flesh out the idea of boomer eschatology. I've mentioned this a few times. There's a trend among conservatives, especially kind of the older crowd, among establishment conservatives especially, but even many who have joined kind of the MAGA movement, this idea that Christianity and America would coincide, that the cultural Christianity of the United States was eternal and would always continue until basically the end of the world. I want to dive into that, where that came from, and how that impacts us today. I also want to take a quick look at the Supreme Court. We obviously have some very important cases, especially one about free speech when it comes to social media. We have Supreme Court justice in particular with very concerning thoughts on that. But before we get to all that, guys, let me tell you about your absolute moral duty to hire based people through New Founding. Hey guys, I need to tell you about today's sponsor, New Founding Talent. Look, we all know that the job market is a disaster right now. Based people can't find good companies to work for, and good companies can't find anybody to get the job done. The competency crisis is very, very real. So how do we get these two incredibly important groups together? We need organizations like New Founding. New Founding has created a network of high excellence professionals who are seeking to join grounded American businesses. These are individuals often in elite organizations who are ready for a team and a mission that supports their values instead of working against them. Aligned companies are already using this network to hire high trust, exceptional individuals who can match the culture and mission of their teams. So if you're looking for better employees to build a better world, you need to go ahead and apply for access to the New Founding Talent Network at newfounding.com/talent. You'll get connected with candidates who will build your business. That's newfounding.com/talent. Check it out today. All right. So boomer eschatology, what do I mean by that? Where did this idea come from? So most of you probably know that the word eschatology is talking about the end of the world, kind of the end of days, what would happen in that scenario. And I think that, again, like I said, a lot of older conservatives linked in many ways the existence of a Christian America to basically the end of the world. If the Christian American empire, if the idea that America would be eternally around or eternally Christian somehow came to an end, that could only coincide with the actual end of the world. They couldn't imagine a world where America was not the most dominant power. It was not kind of the ruler of the globe, and also that it was not also very Christian. And so those ideas, I think, are very linked to the way that a lot of older conservatives believe that history would unfold. You know, a lot of us laugh at the idea of the end of history, the Francis Fukuyama neoliberal, all politics will be solved, all conflict will have come to an end. We've settled on Western liberal democracy and capitalism as kind of the only systems that will ever be in the world. They have beat out everyone else. They are eternal. Then we don't have to have any conflicts over this anymore. We don't have to have any debates or discussions over this anymore. That question is settled. We've reached the end of history in the sense that any political or economic questions need to be solved anymore. And now everything will be purely procedural, right? These things will only be solved by working out the mathematical formulas, not by having any of those messy conflicts that used to dominate our understanding of religion or any of these other things. We kind of laugh at that now, looking at what has happened at the end of history. Francis Fukuyama himself has had to revise his own theory about the end of history because it didn't really happen. These conflicts continued. It turned out humanity moved on and continued to have the problems and conflicts that it had previously, and history was not as over as he had assumed. I think that while we can laugh at that, there is a very similar version of this when it comes to American identity and American Christianity. You look at a lot of older conservatives, and while they were often themselves Christian, and maybe even they fought back against the pushes to get rid of Christianity, especially in particular areas, they fought back against particular social issues. The general idea that America would have to embrace a Christian identity is something that they were still very uncomfortable with, or if they weren't uncomfortable with it, they didn't fight very hard to keep it around. There wasn't a desire to further Christendom in the way that there had been with many other Christian civilizations. They often didn't even think of America explicitly as a Christian nation. Maybe implicitly, there were the norms of Christianity that informed a lot of what America was. If you ask them, should America have Christian values? They would say yes. But the idea that you needed to actively protect the identity of America as a Christian nation was one that simply did not exist for a lot of people in the boomer generation. And I think this is why we're seeing a resurgence in this idea of Christian nationalism. Now, I've raised my own problems with that formulation. Again, I'm not largely against the propositions that most Christian nationalists are for, but I think there is a branding issue and a little bit of issue when it comes to defining what was the classical understanding of American identity as some kind of new Christian nationalism, because that discards all of the history. It discards that connection with the past, and it gives up your stronger position as something that was here in the roots and history of the United States, and instead kind of casts it as a new, trendy, radical social movement, which is what the left wants to do with it. But that aside, the point is, I think the reason that that has re-entered the conversation in a big way is this is a kind of a after the horse is already out of the barn, trying to close the gate and be like, oh yeah, no, we really probably should have had this Christian identity at some point. Now, the question you want to ask yourself is, why did boomers not fight for this Christian identity in the way that many others would have? Why was that not at the forefront of their understanding? And again, I want to say two things. One, this is not all people from the baby boomer generation. Of course, there were people who were lions who fought against this, who spoke out against this. This is a statement about the general trend, not specific people. There are many exceptions, and they should be praised for their efforts. And I also want to say again that that does not mean that the baby boomers weren't Christian. In fact, as we can just see from trends, they were more Christian probably than many generations. Though, again, we can probably debate different issues inside the levels of commitment to Christianity. But you can see a lot of people who were baby boomers and to some extent Gen X look at the idea of Christian nationalism or look at the idea of cultural Christianity now with almost disdain, saying you don't need this around. This didn't need to be part of our identity. This didn't need to be part of who we are. This is something, in fact, it's better for Christians to be persecuted. Real Christians face persecution, and that actually grows the faith. And so we don't need a Christian society. We don't need a cultural Christianity. We don't need Christian institutions or a Christian public square. In fact, it would be better if we were against this. And you have to ask yourself, why would you say that, right? Like, what would bring someone to say that about their own civilization? It kind of fits in, honestly, with the archetype of the boomer as the person who doesn't care what gets handed down to their children. Well, I lived in a Christian society, and so, you know, that's fine. As long as I got to live under those norms, then I don't really have to worry about passing that down to my posterity. We'll get into that more in a second, but it does fit into that archetype. But what would lead them, again, to this idea that history was over and they didn't need to create this continuity of Christian culture? Why would they have that understanding? I think there's a couple things involved here. First, of course, we don't, in the United States, we were successfully sold the idea of separation of church and state. Now, the separation of church and state, that language does not exist in the Constitution. It does not exist in the First Amendment. Most people don't understand that. They don't understand that it was in a letter, separate. It's from one founding father. It does not imply that this is how everyone felt about religion in the United States. And either way, it wasn't in the Constitution, so it shouldn't have any binding power there. There is the Establishment Clause. But then many people also misunderstand that as well. There were actually literally state churches. Different states had different official churches. It wasn't until the incorporation of the First Amendment, something that I probably want to go ahead and do a episode on as well. Me and Ryan Turnipseed have talked about doing an episode on that in the past, and we should probably get into a deeper dive on what the incorporation of the First Amendment means. Up until that point, this did exist in the United States. However, I think a lot of people, especially of kind of the post-war, people who were born in the post-war consensus, the post-World War II consensus, were sold this idea that the United States really was this melting pot, that it didn't have a specific history, it didn't have a specific people, it didn't have a specific tradition beyond one of inclusion and equality, and it's a nation of immigrants, this kind of stuff. And that led them to kind of get into the maximal definition, right? What, how far can we possibly stretch the idea of the United States to allow as many people as possible kind of live here and be identified as Americans? And Christianity was one of the casualties of that. The idea of a truly Christian culture kind of had to go out the window. America could continue to operate through the 50s and 60s as a nominally Christian culture, but it's not something that could be the defining identity, something that would be stamped in to a lot of the institutions. You can see some of the actual reaction to this attitude, I think, because you started seeing things like In God We Trust get put onto the money that wasn't originally there, that gets introduced in some of these periods. So there certainly are cultural currents pushing back against this zeitgeist, but overall, this is the direction that I think people are moving, or were moving during that time, and being guided by the elites, because again, we're believers of elite theory in on the show. We believe that elites drive our culture. And so there's a direction that we were moving, and that was not just bubbling up from, you know, the popular will. They didn't all get together and say, man, I really hope that we start think of ourselves as a secular country. But I think that was a big part of it, because we didn't have an official state church. A lot of Americans got sold the idea that, well, then if you don't have an official church, then you aren't really explicitly perhaps a Christian nation. We also have this loose confederation of Protestant Christianity that bound our many different identities together. The United States has never had one total unified forged identity. It was very regional due to its size and the different ways of immigration that were eventually introduced into the United States. And so even if you weren't Christian yourself or even Protestant yourself, the thing that kind of bound America together was the expectation that you would conform to a certain level of Protestant Christianity. This is why, for instance, Catholics and Jews that moved to the United States often founded their own church, or rather not their just their own churches or synagogues, but their own schools. They kept their own communities separate, because the education that would be handed out in an American public school was assumed to be Protestant in nature. It was not going to cater to Catholic or Jewish particularities. And so if you wanted to keep those particularities, you needed your own separate schools to go ahead and do that. And that's why you have a robust tradition of those kind of private schools inside the United States. And so this kind of loose coalition of Protestant Christianity was the binding moral fiber of the United States, the binding identity of the United States in many ways. But because it was not explicitly stated that America, well, we are Protestant Christians, and here is our state church, and here are our doctrines, and here are the things that we adhere to, this kind of became the background radiation for a lot of people. And as the culture changed significantly, a lot of that just became assumed, right? So that background Protestant Christianity got pushed further and further backwards to the point where you didn't really know where it came from. You still have the social norms, the customs that were built in by that Protestant Christianity, but you didn't really know where they came from. The generation that was inheriting them, that baby boom generation, was starting to lose contact with the actual root of that culture, as so often happens when you start to see a failure of people passing things on. So again, not to just beat up on the baby boomers here, this is a failure of the previous generation, right? The parents of the baby boomers did not properly pass on the centrality of Christianity, specifically Protestant Christianity, to the American culture. And therefore, the baby boomers who went ahead and kind of existed in a new generation without as much connectivity to that tradition, then did not have that root. And when it came time to raise their own children, they did not pass that on to Gen X and to the millennials and so on and so forth. And so this is a cascading problem. We can recognize it. I think most in the baby boom generation, it becomes most evident in this transitional period. But to be clear, this is a failure of multiple generations. This is a gradual decline in identity and understanding across many different groups. We're not just beating up on the baby boomers here, though, to be fair, of course, they played a large role in this, especially due to their outsized impact on American culture because of just the massive demographic size of that group. That they wielded that power throughout their lifespan, and that has had a big impact on the way that America is developed. So because this moved into the background, because this became less of at the forefront of identity and became just kind of the assumed culture without any real connection to its roots, I think a lot of boomers started to believe in the truth of secular government. Even those that were devoutly Christian, even those who believed very much in their Christian faith, started to believe in the myth of a secular neutral state. Okay, yes, of course, I am a Protestant Christian, and perhaps I want my president to even be a Protestant Christian, right? Though obviously that was a big source of contention when it came to people like John F. Kennedy, right? The fact that he was a Catholic was still something important, and the fact that he conformed himself in certain mannerisms to WASP norms mattered. The fact that he catered to that identity, even though he himself was an Irish Catholic, made a big difference. It was still something that was significant that would soon fade away. People can't imagine that being something that's important today, but back then that was still a transitional period, and that was something that mattered quite a bit. But we started seeing this, I think, this transition to the idea that even if you're personally Christian, even if you want your leaders to be Christian and have their decisions informed by Christian values, the public square is not explicitly Christian. The public institutions are not publicly are not explicitly Christian, because increasingly, due to large scale immigration, they needed to mix with people who were not explicitly Protestant. Right now, again, there were many people who were Catholic in the United States before this point, and there were other faiths like Judaism that were in the United States at this point, but they were not here en masse, right? You did not have a large amount of Muslims. You did not have a large amount of Eastern European immigrants until later in the 1800s and the new waves that came, of course, after the Hart-Celler Act. And so these transformations were happening much slower, if they happened at all. You did not have kind of these tipping points of large percentages of immigration that demanded that everyone be governed by some kind of a neutral government, one that would not have a particular religious affiliation or bias, or would make decisions based on a particular moral understanding. And so that started to shift due to the large amount of immigration. And you start to see the belief that even if you think in general it's good for Christian principles to continue on as that background radiation of your moral landscape, it can't be present in the actual governance of the United States, because that would create a bias, and we have to be understanding and tolerant, and you know, the melting pot and a nation of immigrants and all of these things. We can't have a preference for a particular way of being or particular understanding of morality or particular cultural frame. And so I think it was easier for a lot of boomers, especially because they're consuming a lot of these ideas in college, to say, okay, well, even if I return back to my Christian faith or something like that later on, I need to find a way to make it okay that the government is kind of making decisions over all these different faiths and all these different peoples. And so the best way to do that is to kind of transform my nominally Protestant morality into this kind of universal secular application. I want to get deeper into the role that I think college played and the generational transition played in boomer eschatology. But before I do, guys, let's go ahead and hear about New Foundings Venture Fund. Hey guys, I need to tell you about New Founding Venture Fund. Look, we all know that the current system, the current companies out there, the current institutions, they're old, sick, dying, they're sclerotic, they're lame. They can't produce anything of value. And that means that young, talented, innovative people are trying to break out, break free. That's bad news for the establishment, but it's good news for us because that means those people are going to go out and found new companies, create new technologies, and figure out a way forward for our country. If you're interested in being a part of that exciting new future, then you need to check out the Venture Fund. New Founding has rallied the founders who have massive visions for a better future and is investing in these companies through its Venture Fund. The companies they invest in are defined by a simple question. Does the country we want to live in need the company this person is building? Look, venture investing isn't for everyone, but if you're a serious, accredited investor who wants to see a more hopeful future for this country, go to newfounding.com/venturefund and apply to be an investor. Again, that's newfounding.com/venturefund. All right, so I think that college plays a huge role here. Now, of course, college started to grow post the World War II generation. They come in, they get access to things like the GI Bill for the first time. College becomes a vehicle of social mobility and an indication of class in a way that it hadn't existed before. All of a sudden, college becomes a necessity for a lot of people, when before it was something that was really only done by the rich and perhaps a few people who needed to enter into scholarly pursuits. As we started linking technology and college together, or managerial expertise in college together, more and more people need to go ahead and attend college to move on, to ascend to a different social class, or to go ahead and take their place in their existing social order. So college becomes a huge ritual. And of course, we know that especially as the boomers end up going to college in eras like the 60s, we start to see the counterculture arise very much in the universities. And so all of a sudden, there's this shift in the way that people live their lives. Now, don't get me wrong. There had always been a percentage of young people that rebelled, right? We all know the story of the prodigal son from the Bible. So this is a very old notion that a son might try to leave his family and sow his wild oats and maybe even become his own man in some way, and then return back once he realized he had made some mistakes. This is not new to the boomers. However, most people did not live their lives this way. The idea that everyone just completely rebels and rejects the culture of their parents and exists in a wild hedonism and throws away the religion of their forefathers when they hit 20 or so was not some automatic given like we treat it today. That was a fairly new thing. And that expectation really comes from the baby boom generation, who was the first generation to kind of exist in this incredible moment of plenty, right? You have this incredible economic boom, you have this incredible economic growth, you have this material wealth that allows for people to move away and many times have their education financed, or they can afford to pay for it themselves sometimes, but oftentimes this is in some way being subsidized by the state or their parents or others. They lose a lot of their responsibilities, they move very far away from their hometown, they're introduced to very hedonistic opportunities, and they can indulge in them to great excess. This is also a time when the culture shifts, not just to free love, but drug culture and many other things. And so there's this great period where a large number of boomers kind of threw off the culture, threw off the religious constraints, threw off the traditions and beliefs of their many generations simultaneously in a way that just had not happened. Again, people did do this. There was always some element of this. There is some truth to the fact that there is a normal human call to this, and that some people fall into it. But the idea that one entire generation could en masse indulge in this just simply did not exist beforehand. The simple material realities of day-to-day human existence would not allow you to just check out into this hedonistic utopia and do this for several years of your most formative adult years. In any previous culture, that would have just collapsed your society because no one would have been productive and nobody would have been there to defend your society, and all of these things would have fallen apart. But the United States had a lot of padding because it basically conquered the world in World War II. And so there's a huge kind of peace dividend, as we would call it, very euphemistically. That's another way for saying we destroyed all of our enemies and none of them can threaten us anymore, along with a huge economic dividend. And so the boomers were allowed to do this. And so this broke, I think, a chain that usually exists in culture. And so eventually many boomers came back, right? And to their credit, many of them came back to their faith. They came back and they grew up. They became more responsible. They had families, they had children. And despite pretty wild times, like if you read things like Tom Wolfe's, I'm trying to remember the name of the book, the electric Kool-Aid test or something like that, the electric acid Kool-Aid test, something along those lines. Those are some pretty wild times. You think about today and you think about it being very hedonistic, but we often kind of go back and whitewash the 60s and 70s and how out of control some aspects of the culture were back then. Of course, again, I think they were those normalizations of that behavior were more particular at the time. They weren't across the entire culture. I think social media and other forces have kind of made that a wide spectrum event in our culture in a way that it was a much more narrow and contained event in previous, 60s and 70s type culture, but it was still very, very hedonistic. And even though they lived those very wild, irresponsible, hedonistic lives, many of them were allowed to kind of come back to a certain degree of normalcy. Now, for a lot of boomers, they assume that that was just always the case. That's just how life was, right? And we hear this again today. This is what we heard when we had the social justice phenomenon on campuses, right? When we had the social justice warriors on college campuses in the 2000s, we heard a lot. We heard a lot of boomers say, "Oh well, these kids, these crazy purple-haired, non-gendered kids, they're going to come to their senses. They're going to enter the real world. They're going to have to snap back to real life. They're going to need real jobs, and they're just going to do what we did, right? They'll sow their wild oats for a few years. They'll get out of control on college campuses, but eventually, life will smack them in the face the way that real life smacked me in the face, and." They'll just become normal citizens. This problem will solve itself. But of course, that's not what happened because the boomers' experience was unique to them. It was not a normal cycle that young people go through. So when boomers looked at the social justice warriors and said, oh, all these woke kids are just going to get hit by real life. No, what happened is those woke kids grew up, they got college degrees, they entered the halls of power, and they turned all of culture woke. They turned all of our institutions woke, right? And the reason that the boomers didn't understand why what was going to happen there is that they got to live on kind of the last momentum of Christian culture. The Christian culture that they assumed that they thought was the standard secular way that America would always exist, the normal families and jobs, careers, all these things that they thought people would settle into. That was a function of them being the first generation to truly break from that tradition. So we have this long chain of this tradition and they break from it really hard. But when life comes at them and they realize that actually just living as a complete hedonist with no real skills and no real connections is not actually a great way to live. The world was still there, that enough of that tradition was still there, enough of that kind of civilizational scaffolding, that skeleton that Christianity provided for our culture, enough of that was still there for them to go ahead and reconstruct a real life around that. And so they said, oh, well, that's what people do, right? They go out, they do what I did, because you need to normalize your own behavior. Everyone has to assume that kind of, you can't go out and be like, oh no, I was a real piece of trash. And like, I threw the inheritance of my forefathers away and I completely wrecked my society. Like, you can't tell yourself that. So you just have to be like, well, no, of course, kids, they all go out and just do a ton of drugs and have a wide spectrum of sexual partners and enter into all kinds of insane behavior. And then they all just eventually they figure it out and they come back and it's fine. Right. That's kind of the story that they needed to tell themselves about how human civilization worked so they could normalize their own behavior. And they had some reason to believe that, because when they came back from kind of their wild days, from their college days, there was still enough of Christian culture for them to come back and settle into those old patterns and ways of being without paying a really significant cost for some of the things that they did. But that wasn't true for subsequent generations, right? You started to see that the constant grind, the constant loss of kind of intact families, the loss of religion, the loss of real communities, the loss of stable employment and careers. These things started to wear on subsequent generations. The boomers still got their pensions, right? They're still set up for Social Security. They get to retire, all those things. But Gen X, the millennials, all these subsequent generations, they did not. And you could start to see that cultural wear and tear, that eventual devolution of institutions start to cause real problems. You started to see Gen X still mostly formed families, but they didn't stay together. There's a real divorce culture. And then you got to millennials, and many of them started to fail to form families. They failed to launch careers. Millennials are kind of famous for that, living with their parents for too long, not being able to find long-term stable marriages, not being able to have children of their own. And now we're seeing that even more with Zoomers, who are starting to enter into their marriage years, their what used to be home buying years and career years. They're even further behind, and many of them can't even imagine owning a home. Starting a family is increasingly an impossible dream to some of these people. Just these regular patterns of life that we assumed were kind of slowly coming apart. The boomers thought that this had something to do with the fact that maybe the kids just weren't getting up and getting after it. They weren't pulling themselves up by their bootstraps quite the same way that they used to. Again, to their credit, there were a number of boomers who did see the decline of Christian culture as a real problem, fought against it, especially, again, when it came to particular social issues, though they still often had a difficult time understanding it as a necessity of kind of a wider defining identity. And more importantly, the need to wrap your institutions around it. If you want families, if you want churches, if you want communities, you have to prioritize them. You have to prioritize them over economic growth. You have to prioritize them over individuality. But the story of individuality was more sacred, even to many boomers that came back to Christianity, than maybe the actual implications of the Christian faith that they were re-embracing. And so they didn't take care of many of the systems that were continuing to deconstruct the very culture, in many cases, that they were fighting to keep. And this brings me to the actual boomer eschatology. I know I've spent a lot of time laying out the history of the boomers, but here's the actual boomer eschatology, right? Because boomers lost the identity of the United States, and it's not just the United States. We see this in many Western countries, but I'm speaking specifically of my own because that's where I have the most experience. Because they lost that identity, and they lost it religiously, they lost it culturally, they lost it traditionally, they lost it all over the place. And because they increasingly needed to facilitate the integration of large-scale immigration, they needed to see the religious and ethnic and cultural makeup, linguistic makeup, everything of their country increasingly had to go ahead and govern a much larger and diverse amount of people that didn't have a shared moral vision or cultural coherence or identity or any of these things. They needed to deify something, right? You needed something that could kind of hold the United States together. And this is where I think we saw a lot of the deification of the Constitution. Okay, well, we don't have a lot of the culture that we used to have. We don't have a lot of the values we used to have. But the Constitution will hold us together, right? That will be the thing. The laws are written down, and none of these new attitudes, none of these new beliefs, none of these new religions can change that. Those things will be here in perpetuity because they're written down. And if they're written down in the Constitution, then they're the law, and the law is supreme, right? We're a nation of laws and not kings or whatever. Rule of law will somehow protect us against all of this. And so they started to deify the Constitution as the main thing that was going to hold them together. They no longer needed the classic elements of nationhood or moral, religious, cultural, traditional identity. They could just go ahead and invest wholly in the kind of this idea that legal positivism would save us from our increasingly fracturing culture. And so they started to invest, I think, America's institutions and the existence of America itself as kind of the continuation of Christianity. As many boomers, I think, reinvigorated their faith in Christianity because they were scared about kind of what was happening to their children and to their families and to their communities and to their nation at large. They invested more and more into their Christian faith, and they needed to believe that all of those institutions that they had neglected and they had left to kind of die on the vine, the things that they in themselves, in many cases, had torn down back when they were younger, they needed to believe that those things would continue on no matter what. And it wasn't so much even the Christian faith that they needed to continue. It was the American institutions that they needed to continue. And so American institutions, in many ways, took on the same importance of religious institutions. That the continued existence of these things meant the continued existence of the culture that my parents handed to me, but I didn't perpetuate and I kind of rejected. But now I'm trying to kind of revive in my older age. I'm trying to embrace in my older age. I'm trying to defend at this moment. I think a lot of them saw that, and that's why they went ahead and started investing that into the American institutions. And in this way, this became the end of history for conservatives, for the right. The end of history was the idea that that Christian America was eternal, that the dominance of Christian America, especially again after the defeat of the Soviet Union, meant that this question was solved. Obviously, our American way of life, you hear that phrase a lot, the American way of life was going to be the thing that was going to take over the globe. I think this is why the rhetoric of George W. Bush and others that pushed the idea that democracy was the universal antidote to all problems in the Middle East and everywhere else. It would bloom like a flower across the deserts of the Middle East. I think the reason that was easy to sell to the boomers was that they really did equate these ideas with Christianity. They conflated them with Christianity. And so one of the things we've seen with the rise of Donald Trump is a large amount of imbuing Christian imagery into Donald Trump. Now, look, there's a lot of things that you can say in favor of Donald Trump, and there's a lot of things that you can say against Donald Trump. And I will do both of them. Donald Trump is a failure in many areas, but he's also the only person who could do certain things. And so there's praise and failure you can heap on to Donald Trump pretty much till the end of days. I'm not here to defend Donald Trump. I'm not here to bury Donald Trump. I'm not here to do that, at least in this talk. But one thing you have to say about Donald Trump is he's not the exemplar of Christian virtue, right? He's just not. I think Donald Trump's probably Christian. I really don't know. Like, I don't really know much about his personal faith. But it's very clear that he has lived a life that is, how we say, not in accord with certain parts of Christianity. And that's okay. We're all sinners. I am certainly one. We are saved by the grace of God, not through our own goodness. I am no more worthy of that than Donald Trump. But to be clear, Donald Trump often does not conduct himself as someone who feels the weight of kind of Christian morality bearing down on his decision. And yet a lot of boomers have injected a lot of Christian imagery into Donald Faith. They've made him the exemplar of kind of the Christian cause, right? Even though he's very obviously not someone who takes that particular mantle very seriously. And they seem to have done this, I think, because they recognize correctly, and this is something that Donald Trump did do, to his credit, that Donald Trump awakens something about American identity that other politicians, even GOP politicians, would not touch with a 1,000-foot pole. I think that one of the reasons the left hates him, one of the reasons the press hates him, one of the reasons, and I know a lot of people will scream at me somewhere, DeSantis supporters are screaming at me that no one fears Trump. But I think a lot of the reason that the media reacts the way, I think a lot of Democrats react the way they do to Trump, is they really do feel like he touched the live wire of American identity in a very real way. And part of that is Christianity, no matter how people feel about that. And so when he touched that live wire and boomers felt that, right? And they said, look, someone's actually fighting for the good of my country again. They're actually looking to return to an American identity that I recognize. One of the things that they added to that was the revival of American Christianity, the prominence of American Christianity in the American identity. And so even though Donald Trump is in no way, I think, really an exemplar of that identity, they made him one because that was part of the American identity, especially the ones that boomers remembered. And that's something that they wanted to return back to. And they kind of superimposed that on Donald Trump. And again, I'm not even saying that's a bad thing. I think that's just a thing that people do, right? I think that in many ways, great man history is true. That great men do drive history and they do things that other people wouldn't do. And they create situations and grab a hold of movements that other people couldn't grab a hold of. But I do also believe that trends and forces have a very serious impact on people. I think that many people are caught in a political moment. And while a great man needs to step to that political moment to completely culminate that movement, I think that world historical forces and political trends do find themselves working on particular people. And I think Donald Trump is one of those people, maybe the most unworthy of people for that to happen to, but he is nevertheless one of those. And that's just a political reality, something I try to explain to a lot of people who don't like Donald Trump, but oftentimes they have a hard time understanding that. But whether you think this is good or bad, I think this is just true. And so for a lot of the boomers, I think the reason that they have a hard time understanding that a post-Christian America or a post-America world could exist is that they have so much tied the American experience and American institutions into their spiritual beliefs. And they can't imagine a world where Christianity is reduced to a minority faith or where America is reduced to one of just many players or maybe even a smaller player on the world stage. They can't imagine that. And so for them, the end of America or the end of Christian America is the end of the world. Christ, the only way that America could end or the only way that Christian America could end is literally the return of Christ. Nothing else could bring this about. And that's why they didn't feel the need, I think, to fight many of these things. I think ultimately, in a lot of ways, this is a justification for inaction, right? I don't have to take action to protect my faith. I don't have to take action to protect my country. I don't have to take action if people are trying to change the identity and the way, the traditions and the way of being of my country and my culture. I don't have to do these things because they're eternal. They're protected by the Constitution. And the only way they would ever go away is if Christ returned, right? Like ultimately, God will simply make the United States Christian again, or will make the United States preeminent again, as if it was somewhere in Revelation, right? Like if it's you could quote chapter and verse where the trumpets are blown and America is the one that kind of ushers in the return of Christ on his throne. And so I think a lot of them use this as the reason, again, that they didn't have to pass down their heritage. I don't have to work that hard to make sure that my kids are Christian. I don't have to work that hard to make sure that my community is Christian. I don't have to work that hard to make my society hold to a particular tradition. I don't have to do any of this. I don't have to do any of the hard work. I don't have to be called mean names. I don't have to get my hands dirty, because ultimately the only way that kind of America could stop being Christian or America could stop being the most powerful country in the world is if the world literally ended. And so when I talk about boomer eschatology, that's what I'm talking about, is this attitude that we didn't really need to take an active role in this, or we didn't really have to do the work, or if we failed at this, it's not really a problem. Because ultimately, you know, the only way that these things could really disappear, the only way the Constitution could ever no longer secure these freedoms or protect us as a Christian nation is if literally just the world ends. And so I don't have to take any particular action, because ultimately God will kind of involve himself. There'll be a divine intervention to make sure that my country is the very last one. My kind of religious generation is the very last one. Again, it is a very boomer mindset. Like, I, the world ends with me, right? And so once I'm gone, you know, that's it. And so I think that is very much the way that a lot of people thought about this. And so I just wanted to bring up that concept, guys, because I think it does rule a lot of the way that many people understand America. And that is a huge problem. I think it's going away to a large extent, which is good. But I do think it had a serious impact on the way that politics was done on the right, in conservative circles, in Republican circles for a very long time. All right. So the other thing I wanted to do was play this clip from a Supreme Court hearing here recently. The Supreme Court has been hearing a number of cases. And of course, Ketanji Brown Jackson is one of the justices, often the most embarrassing justice on the bench. And she said this during a case that they were hearing recently.
Ms. Jackson?
So my biggest concern is that your view has the First Amendment hamstringing the government in significant ways in the most important time periods. I mean, what would you have the government do? I've heard you say a couple times that the government can post its own speech, but in my hypothetical, you know, kids, this is not safe, don't do it, is not going to get it done. And so I guess some might say that the government actually has a duty to take steps to protect the citizens of this country, and you seem to be suggesting that that duty cannot manifest itself in the government encouraging or even pressuring platforms to take down harmful information. So can you help me? Because I'm really worried about that, because you've got the First Amendment operating in an environment of threatening circumstances from the government's perspective, and you're saying that the government can't interact with the source of those problems.
And Your Honor, I understand.
So this is an amazing thing, right? It's an amazing quote. A lot of people heard this and thought that this was just wild, that a Supreme Court justice would say this, that anyone would voice these opinions out loud. And that's kind of the beauty of, I guess, the beauty and sadness of degenerating elites. They often start saying the things that they've been thinking for a very long time, and they just say them out loud as if they're obvious arguments, because this is what they've been saying to themselves for a very long time. It's what they've been saying in their law schools, in their college classrooms. It's what they've been saying in the boardrooms and the activist meetings. This is what the left really believes, to be very clear. This is what pretty much every leftist really believes. And unfortunately, even many establishment, kind of neocons and such at this point, this is what they believe. And they're just saying it out loud. They're just finally saying what had been the quiet part out loud, to use the famous phrase, because they're just getting dumb. And not just that they're getting dumb, though they are getting dumber, but also because this argument has been made among very smart people, or what they think are very smart people, elites and elite institutions, this argument has been made amongst them many times. And so they feel that the answer is obvious. This is like the really stupid Reddit atheist, right? The really stupid Reddit atheist who has made, they're like, but have you guys ever thought about the fact that there's pain in the world and pain is bad, and therefore God can't exist? Because he's all powerful, pain wouldn't exist. As if there wasn't a large body, as if the problem of theodicy had never existed. No, C.S. Lewis had never written The Problem of Pain. No major scholars or doctors of the church, no philosophers, none of the church fathers had ever thought about this. They're the first person to ever bring this up. Thanks, man. Because they've only ever had these conversations amongst themselves, and they think they're very smart. And so on a 13-year-old Reddit atheist forum, that seems like a really good argument. And so you'll still hear people like Sam Harris just blurt this out as if no one has ever countered this argument before. And the same thing is happening here. A lot of people in these circles have thought exactly this for a very long time. And they've circulated this idea, and it goes around MSNBC, and it goes around NPR, and it gets circulated in a bunch of books and that leftists read. And so eventually one of them just blurts this stupid stuff out. Like, this is just obvious. Of course, this is a good argument. All of my leftist friends agree with it, right? And all of a sudden the right says, what? What are you talking about? Like, this is very obviously wrong. But you need to understand this is not obviously wrong. So what is she saying here? Well, she's saying that the First Amendment is a bit of a problem for her. She's concerned about it. She is worried that the First Amendment might hinder, might put a little hitch in the government's plan to moderate what you can say. The First Amendment is something to consider among many other considerations. It's not something that is paramount. It's not something that has incredible force. It's not an a priori assumption that we can rest upon and then make all of our decisions on. It's just one of many viewpoints that's up for discussion. And everyone on the right's like, oh, this is crazy. How could you say this? But of course you can say this. Excuse me. And she can say this for exactly the reason that I discussed, right? Constitutions are only held in force. They're only in force. They only hold back government power to the extent to which they are a reflection of the general attitude, the general moral understanding of the people. The Constitution did not make America. Americans made the Constitution. And this is always true. Constitutions never make peoples. Peoples make constitutions. And so when you no longer have the same culture, the same tradition, when your tradition and your culture and your identity is just one of many in a large melting pot, one of many stories and narratives that is vying for control and vying to be heard in your democratic process, then it starts to lose its force, right? It starts to lose its ability to hold things together. And even though that truth is written down in a constitution somewhere, it's immortalized in your First Amendment, the meaning and force of that First Amendment is actually not self-evident. That's one thing that people don't understand. The only reason that truths could be self-evident, as they're cited in the Declaration of Independence, is that you have a shared moral vision. You have a shared culture. You have a shared understanding of the world around you. And if you do not share those things, then those truths cannot be self-evident. And so while it may seem clear to you that the First Amendment allows people to speak and the government doesn't have the ability to go ahead and censor them, and that is the obvious and clear and direct meaning of the First Amendment, that is not clear to other people. It is not self-evident. And it doesn't matter how clear the language is, right? A lot of people pretend like it's all about the language of the Constitution. If only the Second Amendment had been more clear. If only they hadn't thrown in the Elastic Clause or the Commerce Clause or any of these things, they wouldn't have been able to manipulate the Constitution. Wrong. It's not the language of the Constitution that's the problem. It's the people interpreting the Constitution that's the problem. If you have people who don't care about your tradition, they will make the words on paper say whatever they want them to mean. And that is very clear. It's very clear that Jackson does not care about the intent of the First Amendment. She does not care about the tradition of the Fourth Amendment. She does not care about the moral force of the First Amendment. She does not care. A culture that can redefine marriage, a culture that can redefine what the words man and woman mean, can certainly redefine the First Amendment. That is small ball compared to what has already been redefined in the United States. So of course she has no problem redefining the First Amendment. Of course she thinks that the First Amendment is just one of many arguments that's being put forward, and the safety and security of the people, the ability of the government to go ahead and get rid of disinformation and misinformation is just as valid as the rights secured in the First Amendment. Of course she believes that. But she has no interest in the tradition that actually holds the First Amendment sacrosanct. She is completely unconnected from the tradition, the moral vision, the history and understanding that would make the First Amendment what it is. And we have allowed this to happen. We thought that simply the words on paper were the critical thing, and not the culture, and not the morality, not the religion, not the tradition, not any of these other things. It's just the word, the legal parchment, is what will secure your rights. And we were very, very wrong. And now we are paying the price for that. So we shouldn't be surprised when someone like Jackson says the obvious thing that most leftists actually believe, which is that the First Amendment doesn't really matter, and that the concerns that the regime has about information and what people are saying and the safety of the people, whatever, is paramount and not the First Amendment. We should not be surprised at that at all. We created a culture that no longer cared about these things. And the words on the paper will not save you. Constitution is not magic. It is not a sacred document. Sorry. It does not have the force that you want it to have. The only reason it had a force in the first place is that God had written onto the hearts of the American people the importance of these things, the importance of these truths, the importance of these values. And as soon as you changed those people, as soon as you disassociated the populace of America and the identity of America from the traditions that brought you the First Amendment, you were inevitably going to get the deconstruction of the First Amendment. It was only a matter of time. And the fact that they have deconstructed far more important things, again, like what a woman is and what a marriage is, should have put you on notice that your constitutional rights would be next. And there would be no more protection for those constitutional rights than there were for the definitions of things that have literally existed since the dawn of time, since the entirety of human social formation. If those things can be redefined, then certainly the First Amendment can be redefined. And so it is being redefined by people like Jackson. And it will continue to be until you realize that this is a critical aspect. All right, guys, we're going to go ahead and transfer over to the questions of the people here real quick. Creeper Weirdo says, I'm going to ask this nicely as I can. Is boomer a DR buzzword? It feels like a buzzword to me. Also, you can't blame your dad forever, guys. This is true, right? I actually already did a stream about this. You're the boomer now and why you can't solely blame boomers for everything. It doesn't mean that they aren't liable for a number of things. It doesn't mean that there isn't blame that is fairly placed on a generation. But we cannot sit here and blame our parents forever, or in this case, probably our grandparents for many of you. And so I think that's absolutely true. However, no, it's not a buzzword. This is in pretty common usage. If you talk to anyone, especially younger generations, they don't actually link it to the boomer generation. They just link it to anyone older than them. So for instance, I am most certainly a boomer to a large number of, Gen Zers and beyond. Creepy Rita says, you're going to have to talk to Doug Wilson eventually, Oren. It's going to happen. Also, you mixed up taking for granted and letting go of. Sorry, I don't know the second reference there somewhere in the talk. But I've seen Doug Wilson, some of his videos and those things. I'd be happy to have a conversation with Doug eventually. He actually ended up reviewing one of my videos at some point, seemed to like it. So I'd be more than happy to talk to him eventually, just haven't put that together yet. Reese says, thanks for the stream. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Appreciate the support, guys. Always nice to have you guys come by, get to do these live. Florida Henry says, growing up in the 70s and 80s, states and counties were fighting back. This was pushed by the courts, TV, corporations, and public schools. Boomers were garbage, waiting for your audiobook. Well, thank you very much. Obviously the book is coming out in May, May 7th. I have heard that there is going to be an audiobook, but it's still in the works, so I can't give you any more information on that. And yes, like you said, there were absolutely people pushing back in the 70s and 80s. Again, I do believe that this is an elite phenomenon, as most cultural transformations are. So this was most definitely being pushed down by entertainment, large corporations, courts, and things like that. You're 100% correct about that. But of course, the question is, why did the generations there still make that transition? I think you're right that there were people pushing back. That's why I made sure to give credit to that. But I do think overall there is a large degree of cope as to just kind of how that came about that still exists in the wider populace. Perspicacious Heretic says maybe it's actually the boomers getting put away. To some extent, that's probably true. The boomer truth regime, I believe, as AA calls it, is most certainly facing the possibility of being put away. Let's see. Laws and like Kurgis says, Trump was a clown show in our minds until he spoke about topics and that parties refused to, since that was his road to victory. Everything else was just show. Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that, right? For the most part, it was very clownish. It was very cartoonish. There's a reason a lot of people didn't take him seriously at the beginning. However, it was his ability and willingness to discuss things that you weren't supposed to or weren't allowed to discuss that really gave him his momentum, even though he didn't always do that well, and even though he didn't even follow up on many of those things. It was simply his willingness to do that and his willingness to kind of attack, I think, the people that attacked much of Middle America that gained him the following that he received, even though in many ways he was very cartoonish. Let's see here. Cooper Ritter says, but Oren, someone might say the N-word and pwned. Yes, that is the most dangerous thing that could ever happen. That is the ultimate sin and the one thing that can never happen. Everyone must be terrified of that at all times. Let's see. Tiny Stupid Demon says, institutional capture means we can stop lying and start saying the quiet part out loud. Yes, in many cases, that's true, right? We, now that the left feels like they control all of these institutions, they no longer have to play the game. They don't have to give any credit to the old narrative of the United States, the old civic religion, the old political formula of the Constitution and the founding and those things. And instead, they can just go ahead and say what they mean. I think you're right that that's a huge reason we're seeing a big shift in language. Daedalus says, when I'm weaker than you, I ask for freedom because that is according to your principles. When I am stronger than you, I take away your freedom because that is according to my principles. Yes, that's a very powerful truth. Many people link that to Dune. It does appear Frank Herbert in Dune. However, I think he got that from a journalist of some type. But either way, that's certainly the place most people know that quote from is from Dune, and it is both powerful and true. Laws says again here, the values of freedom and equality come from the merchant class. To see everyone as a customer and desire the freedom to sell and go without opposition. Yeah, in many ways, that's true, right? These are things that are liberal values because liberalism is in many ways the kind of political theory, or rather the larger moral and political understanding of capitalism, right? These are things that make capitalism run. And that's why liberalism became kind of this dominant force, because it kind of had to go and make different nations ready for kind of the capitalist project, and therefore kind of the merchant class. And so I think that's right. Though, to be fair, freedom and liberty are things that people use interchangeably, and I think that's dangerous. Many ancient peoples understood the importance of liberty, thought of themselves as free people in the sense of having liberty. But I think that we have kind of destroyed that word in many ways, made that a purely economic or more morally relativistic thing instead of something that kind of the average person understands as a way to exist where you are not influenced by kind of the rule of foreign people, which is more what it meant previously. Seneca says, the cycle of regimes, when the people leave their founding principles, they are doomed to destruction. Yeah, I think that's very true. I think that, you know, cyclical history, especially when it comes to the rise and fall of different civilizations, different empires, is largely correct. And I think that many people assume that we were not going to be subject to this, but we are. And that was part of the boomer eschatology as well, that the United States would be eternal in a way that other nations had not been. Because we were at the end of history. And then Law says one more time, liberalism was written by philosophers and merchants. And again, very, very hard to argue that point. All right, guys, we're going to go ahead and wrap this up. Thank you so much for coming by. Always great getting to do one of these solo live streams with you guys, answer a bunch of your questions, go ahead and, you know, just give me my thoughts, give it more extended explanation. It's nice to, of course, do the interviews too. But always nice to be able to kind of discuss ideas at length and flesh things out. So I appreciate you hanging with me. All right. If you are here for the first time, of course, make sure that you go ahead and subscribe to the YouTube channel. Make sure that you go ahead and click the bells and the notifications and everything else that you need to do so you can go ahead and catch these streams when they go live. And of course, if you'd like to get these broadcasts as podcasts, make sure that you go ahead and subscribe to the Oren McIntyre Show on your favorite podcast platform. When you do leave a rating or review, it really helps with the algorithm magic. And finally, if you would like to get the book that a couple people mentioned, The Total State, it will be coming out on May 7th, but you can go ahead and pre-order it on places like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. Many of the large retailers will have it there for you to purchase, pre-order. Thank you guys so much for watching. And as always, I'll talk to you next time.